Thank you for tuning into the VF1 show with VF and Vincenzo, the podcast that discusses all things business, marketing, politics, and government within the world of Formula One. If that's your thing, then you found the right place. So without further ado, it's lights out and away we go.
Welcome back to the show. This is VF1 with Vincenzo and VF. Vanessa, how you doing today?
I am good. We are recording this on a Friday, which is usually the day we release our podcast. So it's kind of a good thing because we get a feel of the Australian Grand Prix and all that. How are you feeling today?
Good, good. I just got a chance to watch FP2. I tried to stay up late last night for me in the Eastern time zone. It started at 1 a.m. I tried to catch it because I was doing something else and I was up late and I turned it on and fell asleep. And it ended up raining at the GP anyway because I ended up watching it this morning before we recorded. And it was like, okay, I didn't miss anything. I literally missed nothing. There was something exciting that happened at the GP. Did you see the attendance they had at practice one?
Yes, I did.
Massive.
That was so cool. I love seeing that.
Over 122,000 people showed up to watch practice.
Wow.
We're talking practice, man. Sorry, I had to go AI for a second.
It's interesting, though, that would happen the week that they said, who was it? Domenicali, I think, who said that they would be in favor of removing one or two or something of the free practices, and yet they have over 100,000 people showing up at FP1 at the Australian Grand Prix. Maybe the fans like free practice.
Yeah. And listen, I don't know the extreme passion of the Australian fans, but I would venture to guess that being in Australia, you don't have a lot of, for the majority of folks, have the opportunity to get to see a lot of Grand Prix, right? I know that some of the Asian Grand Prix are probably closer, you know, like Singapore might be within distance, I think, like in a decent distance. I don't know the cost. I haven't looked it up, so I don't want to say anything with confidence, but I would say that being in Australia, it's probably not really easy to get to a lot of other GPs around the world. I mean, you're pretty far away from everything, right? We don't realize how fortunate we are here in the United States. Not only do we have three GPs of our own, one in pretty much every time zone, right? Like, we are also a very short flight or drive to Canada, Mexico. Brazil is not that far. You can be in any of the European GPs in about 5 to 6 hours by flight. From the eastern part of the country, so we're really spoiled, and the Australians don't. I don't think they have that, you know, flexibility or opportunity, just to be within. You know, I'm gonna go pick up and go to the, you know, Monaco Grand Prix, or pick up and go to Monza, you know, the Italian GP this week. Like, they can't do that from Australia. I mean, I guess they could, right? But like, most people don't have that ability, and so they show up. They show out. It's a 4-day party. You know, they start on Thursday with other a lot of racing on Thursday, and you've got Friday, Saturday, Sunday. But it is, yeah, it's cool. It's so cool to see. They had a massive attendance last season. Over 450,000 was the number, or 420,000, over 420,000, I think it was, for the weekend, which was the biggest since, I don't know, the 90s for them, and before it was even it at Melbourne. So this is cool. This is cool. I am excited for that. The only thing that doesn't excite me about that is that with Domenicali saying, you know, oh, less practice sessions, and then this happens, and it's like, it definitely justifies what he said, right? It allows, like, hey, people are going to show up, so what do I need more of these for? They're showing up to this. Let's give them real racing, like, instead of just giving them practice sessions. But it'll be interesting to see how far that goes. I've seen a lot of different types of conversations around what Domenicali said, you know, canceling free practice and you know, it's great for the engineers, but the public doesn't like it. I guess, you know what, let's just kick off the show with this one. Do we want to appease fans, or are we trying to get great racing?
Yeah. I think that's pretty much what this comes down to. It's an interesting thing because I feel like with Formula One specifically, so much of what's been done in the last couple of years has been designed, I think, to, well, we know, to kind of neutralize competition with the spending cap, with now the limited time that engineers have in the garages before the Grand Prix. All these different things are supposed to kind of, I think, focus more of the attention on what's actually happening in between the races. And what you put on track is basically the culmination of what you've been working on in between each race. And so I understand that they want to focus more on what can you do in between those races. But at the same time, if giving these teams a little more time on race weekends to iron out the kinks with their cars gives us better racing, or it ends up with several other drivers in a wall, I think that is potentially what we're looking at here. Because at what point do they have to pump the brakes and say, we're taking too much away from the engineers and the mechanics? And sure, it would be nice if those lower series had more time on track. But at the same time, F1 is the breadwinner of all the series. And so you have to at some point decide what's in the best interest of racing and what's in the best interest of how to spend your money accordingly, especially with this cost cap. And I think more attention and more time being spent on the cars is important too.
Yeah, and so that's kind of where I've seen a lot of disagreements, because I've seen former engineers talking and even some current or former drivers and engineers talking, not current, saying that they don't need, what do you need 2-3 practices before you go out and qualify? Like, it's not necessary. I've seen literally former engineers saying the practice sessions are totally boring. Some of the times, they don't even go out there for practice three, right? Or they'll do some laps, but they're not putting down times that they really care about, or they're just trying to save tires at that point. So it is a fascinating discussion, because me as a, you know, growing up, going to races as a kid, you know, the exciting part was the cars going around the track. Like, that to me was always exciting, and just hearing the cars and seeing them. And it doesn't matter what they're doing. Yes, obviously if they're racing, it's fun, but I mean, let's face it, some of these races that are total blowouts, right, where you've got a driver finishing laps ahead of the back markers, they may resemble a practice session, you know? Like, they might not even be as exciting as a practice session where the cars are all going out there putting down laps, or qualifying, where cars are really out there pushing hard. So does it, you know, are you taking away from the fans that really care, or are you just trying to appease this new group of fans? And I say that with love, because I know a lot of the newer fans do truly, you know, enjoying the sport. But is it appealing? You know, are they trying to appease? Is F1, you know, trying to just satisfy whatever itch that the new influx of fans has? And what is that itch, right? Have they identified what exactly is the itch? Why are you here? Why do you enjoy this sport? If you came into the sport because maybe you started following TikTokers talking about drivers' personal lives, yeah, you probably don't care about, you know, the on-track action. And going to a GP is going to be very startling to you when you don't get to see your favorite driver up close and they're not walking around, you know, doing TikTok dances. Like, they're not, it's like, that's not what it is, right? And that's where I'm like, okay. We talked about this, I think, three or four episodes ago, where F1 is just at a crossroads and they have to figure out what is the message we're putting out, right? It's like this messaging crisis, and I call it a crisis. It's probably not really a crisis, but what are we putting out? What are we getting back? How are we serving that group? So if the messaging is, you know, we want all sorts of fans, great. But we don't want to, exclude diehards. Great. But we're going to get rid of practice sessions because they're not as exciting. Okay, well, who's that serving? Which group is that serving? So they have to make sure that whatever they're putting out there is in line with, you know, what they're saying and what they're trying to attract. This appears to be a move that would be in line with their movements into the U.S., their movement into, getting more eyeballs. But I don't know. It feels like it takes away from a lot of what makes a three-day race weekend a three-day race weekend, right? You're looking to make this thing a Super Bowl. And again, I'm almost talking myself out of it as I'm talking, because I'm realizing that, yeah, maybe without a practice session and turning it into a time trial is, yeah, maybe that is more exciting for people to watch. Maybe people will care more about it if there's something on the line every day of the 3 days. But are you then taking away from the main event, which is the GP? And that's where I think all of this goes. That was kind of the point I was trying to make there. It was like, if you are trying to... What is it? Like, if everything is important, nothing is important, right? If every single day of the GP weekend, there's some sort of sprint and a qualifying and a time trial and now the race, well, then, I mean, do I really need to watch the race? Do I really need to watch qualifying? There's a time trial, so I can just skip qualifying. Or, you know, I don't have to watch the race. Like, plus the tickets are way more expensive for race day. But they're doing a time trial and a qualifying the day before, you know, and the tickets are half the price. I'll just go to that. You know what I mean? Like, that's the kind of justification that I feel like people will start to make with themselves if every day there's, like, you know, this super exciting thing happening instead of just engineers need to, hey, we got to get times. We have to learn how the tires wear. I mean, if you saw Melbourne, like, the softs are not wearing, the softs aren't gripping. The tires aren't, you know, aren't holding the way they expected them to. You need practice time to see that. I mean, I saw so many back ends step out in the practice sessions I was watching. I was like, man, that's kind of crazy, you know, and it was consistent with a lot of drivers. So you've got to think that that's valuable to put on the best Grand Prix that you could on Sunday. Yeah. All right. I'm done with that rant. I don't want to keep going on that. What else do you want to say about that?
I think what Pierre Gasly said, he said three isn't needed from a driving point of view. I think one, maybe two maximum is enough for all of us. And I think I would be in favor of maybe two practice sessions. But again, it's like, you know, I think at some point, like I said, you got to think about the engineers and what's best for them to make the most competitive cars. And it's, you know, if you're going to eliminate one practice session, then you need to give them a little more time under the hood.
Right. Yeah. I mean, something you can't have. What's that?
I said something has to give there.
Right. No, I agree.
Speaking of,
I don't know.
Damon Hill, did you happen to catch his comments on the F1 Nation podcast last week?
I didn't catch them. I didn't actually hear them on the podcast. I had seen a few folks or a couple articles talk about it, that the Adrian Newey's contract could be or is up for renewal. I don't know the whole situation there. And he is... It sounded like Damon was very, very adamant about the idea that Adrian Newey could go to Mercedes. And the quote that I saw from the podcast was, I can't help ignoring this thing he did in Bahrain where he stood in front of the Mercedes on the grid with his clipboard and stood there for a long time looking at their front wings. Anybody who knows Adrian will go, wait a minute, he's already got the most dominant car in F1. Why is he looking at the Mercedes front wings? Was he really looking at the front wings? Or was he just standing in front of a Mercedes saying, I'm interested, is that what he was really saying? And in that context, when you say it that way, you know, obviously people see, you see what you want to see, right? Like, you can make anything up. But it does make you think, like, okay, he wants to be the best, you know, or he loves, this is a passion for him. He's already built this absolutely dominating car. Now here's I don't want to call it a tractor, but it's not good. And is he sitting there looking at it going, what can I do to this thing to make it a rocket ship? You know? Again, you see what you want to see. You create things that you may want to create, right, in your own head. But it would be interesting to see if, like, he does decide to take on a bigger challenge after this. He's literally built, I want to say he's built all, or he's helped build all of their championship cars at Red Bull.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
he has 11 combined, I think, constructors and drivers championships since he joined Red Bull in what, 2015 or 2005?
Yeah. So he, he's become synonymous with Red Bull at this point, but, you know, for those that know Adrian Newey, he was with Williams McLaren. Before that, McLaren.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's also built other cars. He's not only built Red Bull. It's a fun thing to think about. It's one of those, like, alternative reality things to think about. We don't know what'll happen until we know, or until it happened. But you do think, like, okay, is Red Bull going to give up everything, you know, or pay everything to keep him on board? Do they think that somebody else under Newey, have they been training somebody else? Is, can someone else step in and do what he's done, especially with 2026 coming, around and totally new regulations and whatnot? I mean, you've got to think they would be ready to open the wallet to keep him on board. But you also have to think that other teams would be absolutely chomping at the bit to bring him on board and say, hey, come over here, right? I don't know. It's fun. It's a fun thing to think about.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that with the Newey situation, obviously, you know, he sees an aerodynamics. Like, I don't think it's impossible for him not to look at a single object and think of it from an aerodynamics perspective, right? So I don't think it's uncommon for anyone to really stop by and look at cars. But in that moment, just his observation hat was on. And you can tell he was probably looking at that car very closely, perhaps breaking it apart in his head and putting different elements on the car that he knows would make that car better. And you have to imagine, you have to wonder, really, how many conversations has he had with other teams, perhaps throughout the years, especially in the last 2 years, and how many conversations he's now had with Mercedes. If you're Toto Wolff, he's already said he's not above kind of, you know, mimicking what's working on the Red Bull. And I think that was a very strong statement for him to be making, because the past couple of years, it's been like, Mercedes is the dominant team, catch up to us. And now it's like, okay, what we're doing is not working. We need to go in a completely different direction. We're going to call an audible. And if that audible is looking at the Red Bull and figuring out what can we take from that car and put it on ours to make ours better, that's already a pretty strong statement from Mercedes right now. And I wouldn't put it past Toto Wolff to be doing everything he can right now to be trying to get Adrian Newey over to Mercedes. But I don't know. I think it's anyone's guess. There's absolutely zero evidence that this is actually a thing right now. But obviously, Newey's grid observations have paid off for Red Bull. He's been analyzing other teams' cars for years now, and it's worked. So, yeah, if you are a team principal right now, if you're a team owner, I think you're pretty much throwing a blank check at Nui right now and seeing what it's going to take for him to jump ship.
I mean, to counter that point, if you're Nui, do you move?
I don't know either.
I don't know if I would. But again, I say I don't know if I would move, but I also wouldn't mind a fresh new challenge.
Exactly. And I think that's more of what it is right now. It's like when you are at the height of your game and you've done every single thing possible, you've won championships, you've won constructors, you've created, you know, these championship drivers. At what point are you kind of like, okay, I'm now bored. I want another challenge. It's fun, designing this car every year, but it's not exactly like Red Bull ever comes out with these crazy, insane designs either. You know, everybody kind of makes jokes now and says that, oh, you know, that's a nice car. It looks like the car you had last year. So it's not like they're doing anything particularly exciting to, you know, try out different designs. They're sticking with what works, which you can't hate on it. But again, your job as a constructor is to evolve with, you know, with the car. And I respect teams that have taken a serious gamble to try and test out different technologies. Obviously, with Mercedes, that hasn't worked out with the no pod situation. But yeah, I think if you're someone like Adrian Newey, who puts so much dedication into making the best car, it's like, at what point does the challenge begin to expire? And he might be there. And, you know, does he go to another challenge? Does he find another team? Who knows? But it's definitely an interesting observation by Damon Hill, and one that we should continue to keep tabs on, because I think we kind of know who's going to be competing this year for the constructors, for the Drivers' Championship. And this is just one of those side narratives that I think requires a lot more attention.
Yeah. Here's the thing, and I'll say this, like, yes, it's definitely, it would be a different challenge for him to go somewhere else, but Formula One in general is always, it's always challenging because of how you're approaching building the current car that you have, right? So it's you against the regulations, and it's exploiting as much as you can without breaking the rules. And so I think that's always going to be challenging no matter where you're at. Even if he stays at Red Bull, right? Every year there's different sets, or there's different, regulations that you're trying to figure out loopholes, or loopholes sounds like a bad thing, but really that's what it is. You know, you're trying to exploit these things. And so it can be challenging no matter what, obviously. But would he want to take on a project that's like completely opposite of what he's got? And, you know, that would be the most drastic change, right? Going from Mercedes' current project to something different. So I think that's why, like, that shock factor of what Damon said, it makes it more shocking than to say, oh, I'm going to just say he's going to stay at Red Bull again. But yeah, I don't know. it's really interesting. Speaking of some drivers on the grid, or I guess speaking of some other players on the grid, did you see Otmar? He made a comment about, well, let's rewind. Pierre Gasly had a bunch of penalty points, and I believe he only needs, like, I don't know, very few penalty points where he actually gets a race ban. And Otmar said that teams actually blocked an attempt by Alpine to remove some of those points against his license for track limits after things were clarified. So teams actually blocked it. Do you think this is something that, like, would you do that if you were another team? To a driver who really, I mean, it's like, it's not that Alpine is, you know, they're not a top three or four team. They're kind of hanging around somewhere in the midfield. Do you think that this is one of those, like, gamesmanship type things, or is it, hey, whatever, you broke the rules, you broke the rules?
Yeah. Well, Pierre is in an interesting situation because, like you said, he has 10 penalty points right now. Two are set to expire in May. And if a driver hits 12 points, they get a race ban. So I think that when you actually look at the ebb and flow of Formula One, the regulations, the rules changes, etc., and the fact that the FIA, for the most part, is very inconsistent when it comes to a lot of on-track issues. That we've talked about this over and over again. I will continue to say this. They should be preemptively planning for, and that they shouldn't be making shit up as they go. And it seems like there's been a lot of that over the years too. But I think that with Otmar trying to get teams to agree to remove penalty points for minor offenses, he said there were probably 3 or 4 out of the 10 teams that supported it. Some of those that did not admitted the reason they are not supporting it was for opportunistic reasons, hoping something happens to us. Again, I think that if Pierre was driving for a better team, that might, I think I would buy that explanation more. But again, when you're competing in that midfield and you've got Williams doing a great job this year, you've got other teams that are trying to claw up. You've got McLaren, that is a disaster right now. They're not even competing for midfield right now. They don't even have any points. So right now, it is very cutthroat for any team that isn't Aston Martin, Red Bull, I'll throw Mercedes in there, and Ferrari. And so, yeah, I think that this is one of those things. We talk about politics in F1 and how it's unavoidable. This is one of those political situations that are happening right now where teams are looking at this and saying, what's in the best interest of our team? The best interest of our team right now is if Pierre Gasly perhaps gets a race ban, because that's one less veteran driver on the grid that we have to deal with. So is it fair? Absolutely not. But again, I think the onus continues to be on the FIA for the way it handles these penalty points to begin with.
Yeah, I agree. I also, like, if I'm another team, I'm saying, obviously, if I'm a midfield player, I want them to get as, you know, I don't want them to get as many points as possible. So if they miss a race, and that's, let's say, you know, Pierre could have pulled out 8, 10, 12 points for that race. I mean, that's 8, 10, 12 points that I'm closer to them at the end of the season. And that's the difference between, you know, I've written many blog posts about this, you know, where people don't get excited about midfield battles, but it's a difference between millions of dollars for these teams that can help them in years to come. So, yeah, if I'm another team, me personally, I'm saying, sorry, Pierre. Nope, we're not. You know, you shouldn't get a reduction in the penalty. Now, back to what you said and back to clarification of rules and track limits and things like that. Yeah, if the FIA is unable or inept at managing what constitutes penalties, and then things change and drivers have been penalized and given points based on things that were incorrect, that's a whole different story. Now we're kind of getting into that murky waters. But if I am another team, I'm still going to push for it. I get, you know, Otmar and Alpine's plight, but I don't care if I'm another team, right? So, you know, this is a game of microsecond, you know, thousands of seconds and micrometers. It's, yeah, sorry. If I can get a team ahead of me or near me to be docked, you know, 10 points or lose 10 points at some point, yeah, I mean, I'm doing whatever I can to do that.
Yeah. It's the business. And if you can't handle it, then obviously this isn't the sport for you, because you know how cutthroat this is. Everybody knows how cutthroat Formula One is. All you have to do is look at how the driver lineup changes every couple of years to understand that. I mean, look what happened with Daniel Ricciardo. So, you know, it's not a fair, and I'm using fair in air quotes, sport to be in. It's not fair at all, but you also kind of make your own luck in this too. And there's a lot of drivers that they do everything they can to avoid penalties. And I think that Pierre has to, he's been in Formula One way too long to get himself into situations where he could possibly face penalties. He knows better now at this point too. So I have higher expectations this year of Pierre to not get as many penalty points this season. And you know, I think that's just it. You know, you prove that you've learned Formula One by how you respect the rules, I think, and how you can compete while respecting the rules. And this is the year for Pierre to really prove to people that, yes, I am a mature driver and I can handle these situations without accruing these points. And yes, they do need to clarify, and I'm glad that they clarify track limits this year. I'm glad that they've dealt with that, because I think that's been a penalty over the years that people have just been shaking their heads at. But when it comes to the major issues, these are things that every driver on the grid, I mean, we're not just talking Pierre. I think Lance Stroll has 8 points, if memory serves. And again, these are things you've been in the sport long enough to know better.
Yeah. You know, again, I don't disagree there. I think that there, and this is tough to say, it's like rules are rules until they're not, and until someone says that they can change them. So it's like, it comes down to what you said, the whole FIA enforcing certain things and being able to interpret their own rules properly. But yeah, I agree with you. These drivers have been around long enough to know, and to, also, you've accumulated these over a long period of time, right? It's not like it's, oh my God, you did one thing and we're going to ban you, right? Or, you know, like in football, you know, a referee could give a second yellow card, which, you know, gives you an immediate red card. You're off for that game, then you miss the next game. It's not like, oh my God, it was some snap decision, that was a bad call. This is over a course of many races, right? You've accumulated these points. It's not like, oh, you went off the track twice, or you know caused some issue twice. This happened time, you know, over time. So that's where I'm a little less sympathetic to the driver, or sympathetic to the team, because it's like, well, I mean, dude, you knew this going into it. It's yeah, nothing new. So And the inconsistency of the FIA is also nothing new. So it's like, you almost can't even complain, because you knew this was the case.
Yeah, exactly. And these drivers know that. They know that the FIA is consistent. If they're consistent in one thing, it's being inconsistent. Drivers know that. So it's like, they have to learn how to play the game too. And some drivers are better at it than others. So yeah, if you've been in the sport as long as a shape that Pierre has, Stroll, etc., you know better. You know that if the FIA gets a chance to screw you, they will. So do everything you can to stay under those penalty points. Other drivers are successful at doing it, so you know how the game works. And I wish that we could appease every single complaint that every single team principal has. But again, this is the politics of Formula One. You're going to win some, you're going to lose some. You're going to lose most, actually. And, you know, you have to learn how to play the game. And right now it's drivers figuring out how to play the game against the FIA to make sure that they don't face a race ban. And that requires a certain level of maturity. And like I said, got these veteran drivers, we expect more from them too.
Did you, moving on to a couple other stories that I thought were interesting, or we both thought were interesting. Helmut Marko made a comment about Red Bull considering renaming AlphaTauri. But what was interesting was he said that the brand itself isn't selling the AlphaTauri brand. Now, AlphaTauri is a clothing lifestyle brand. There were some rumors of them being for sale, which that's been struck down. I don't know if I believe that, you know, if it's completely not for sale, or if this is all just like, because usually where there's smoke, there's fire, right? So like, if we're hearing all of these things happening, is that really the case, right? Obviously Red Bull is pulling the strings over there, clearly. What do you say on that? I thought the most interesting piece was, because the whole like, oh, it's not for sale. Yeah, okay. Obviously you guys are gonna be saying that. But talking about renaming it and kind of disassociating from the AlphaTauri brand, which is supposed to be, you know, this lifestyle clothing thing. I did find it interesting. Let me add this thought. I did find it interesting that Red Bull did sign with, I believe they signed with Castore, which is a brand, which is a lifestyle brand. They so all their official merchandise is, or they have official merchandise, which I thought was interesting because it's like, well, I mean, AlphaTauri is right there. Why aren't you doing it with them? Unless it's just like they play in different space. Maybe that's why. But I did think that was interesting when they signed that deal with Castore to do, you know, their F1 branded merch. And so now this doesn't surprise me as much, but I was curious to get your thoughts.
Yeah, Red Bull rebranded Toro Rosso in 2020 as AlphaTauri. It was supposed to be the Red Bull clothing line. And I mean, they have pushed this hard over the years. F1 personalities like Will Buxton has been at events in their gear. And I know that there are some F1 employees who even wear AlphaTauri for their uniforms. And I think that when you consider all of the levels that AlphaTauri has gone through to try and promote this brand. I mean, they even launched their new car at New York Fashion Week. So it's like they're trying, but they're not trying to compete in that space with brands that have technical fabrics and, you know, in that space. And so when you think about the fact that AlphaTauri, they only have a physical storefront presence in a handful of countries, it's not the most recognizable brand. It's not like Puma. It's not like Tommy Hilfiger. It's not like a lot of the other brands you see, especially in Formula One. And it's like they're trying to compete against these giants right now. And when you talk about the technical fabric component, I mean, you've got everyone doing that right now. You've got Lululemon getting in this. You've got Nike that's been doing this for decades now, trying to elevate and, you know, figure out their fabrics. Adidas, you're competing with some of the biggest giants. And I get it. What they're trying to do is make technical fabric wearable. They're trying to make these like suits and skirts and, you know, all these different types of different outfit components with this technical fabric. And I understand that. At the same time, where are you going to see that? You're not going to see that in a mall. I don't think you're ever going to see that in like a Saks. So what's the end game here?
So they're only in two countries, which is to add to your point, right? They have three locations in Austria and they have a location in London. Well, you know, and if I'm hearing what you're saying correctly, it's like they're trying to take technical fabrics and all this stuff, but they're not just, I would say, and I would push you on this to say, they're not competing with the Puma and the Adidas and the Nike of the world. They're actually trying to be some high-end brand that no one actually cares about. I mean, and again, maybe someone doesn't, and I would love if somebody is listening to this podcast, like, I love AlphaTauri. I wear AlphaTauri all the time. I spend hundreds of thousands of dollars. But like, if you look at some of the prices on this stuff, you've got $1,000 parkas. I'm sorry, 1,000 euro parkas. I mean, you've got sweaters, jumpers, for the English, $400. Yes, they're performance fabrics, but who's buying these? Because you're not competing with Puma at this point. You're not competing with Adidas at this point. Like, these are even the models they have. I mean, these are like editorial, beautiful. It's great. The idea is great, but I'm trying to figure out, like, are you trying to make fetch happen? Because it's not working.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, for one, they rebranded an entire team for this. That's how invested they were in this. And I just, it hasn't stuck the way I think they wanted it to. And like I said, that's what was the end game, to get it in Saks, to get it in some higher end, you know, a clothing company or clothing store. And yeah, they make some beautiful clothes. They really do. But at the same time, it's just, it's not working. And it's obvious that it's not working because they're they're considering a rebrand just 2 years after. They changed their entire team to revolve around this. And so it's obviously not working. And I feel bad because you think about it, they've put so much time and effort into this. They even have their own registered fabric. It's called the Toro brand. It's a three-layer technology where the membrane is bonded with the outer and inner layer of clothing. And again, the craftsmanship, the development, they have put millions of dollars into this concept. And it's, you know, I've heard mixed comments on this clothing. I've heard that the ones that you actually buy in the stores are beautiful, well-made, they feel good, they fit nicely, but that the ones that the F1 personnel are wearing are not the best. They don't like them. So is there like a varsity version and then like a JV version? It doesn't seem like it's very consistent in its quality. If that's the case, you can't sell this as AlphaTauri and then say it's not as good as you know, some other brand. So I don't know what they're doing with this. I was hoping for the best for this, just because, like I said, from an R&D perspective, you know that so much has gone into this. But
yeah,
you know, where do you go from there without revenue? Yeah. Generation, it's hard for any team to stay competitive. And if you're not competitive, your race results are going to suffer. And I think that when you consider AlphaTauri is not a profitable team right now, you know, they're not going to be competitive.
The team wants, right? Yeah. So team not being competitive. I actually love the fact that we went down that whole fashion route, because our last topic that we were trying to discuss has to do with some clothing and also a Red Bull driver. So that's interesting. But I guess we'll close off with this on the AlphaTauri thing. Team's not successful. I feel a little differently in terms of they should be a separate entity. There's only 10 of these teams on the grid. You know, to have them basically a Red Bull B team, which is what it is. Now, I know people argue and be like, well, the Haas is basically the same thing for Ferrari and whatnot, which is not exactly the same relationship. I mean, Red Bull and AlphaTauri are literally just like A and B. I mean, they are, there's the majors and the minors there. It clear as day. It's very, very apparent how that relationship works. I really would love to see, I don't want to hear, this is my statement. I don't want to hear from Dr. Marco or from Christian Horner on the AlphaTauri team. Like, you never even hear from anyone from AlphaTauri about AlphaTauri. It's always from Marco or Horner. And it's like, piss off, worry about your own team that's dominating, and this team should run itself. Like, so they're, anyway, that's kind of where I stand with it. The rebranding, the clothing, all this stuff, good. I'm glad you guys are failing at something, because your A team is awesome. So at least you guys are failing at something. That's how I feel, candidly.
Ouch. That was harsh. I respect it.
Yeah. And I respect what they're doing on the Red Bull side. It's just like, don't try and tell me that they're not a B team. Oh, they're a completely separate entity. No, they're not. Come on. No, they're not. Like, you guys shouldn't be commenting on half the things you comment on about them. Moving on to Mr. Verstappen. He's actually So Max clothing brand, Max One. Now Max One is, he's using his championship number. He's using the ability to have the championship number one, and coming out with a clothing brand. Clothing brands are apparently all the rage as soon as you get to be like a big deal, right? But I don't know if you've heard of another brand that leverages the Max One, which is the Air Max One shoes by Nike. Yeah. Wow. What's that?
It said she. I wonder who that could be.
Nike. So Nike is apparently they're blocking the attempt to launch this brand. So Max hasn't even launched it yet, and Nike has already stepped in and filed a complaint. So it's on pause at the moment. I don't have a law degree or anything like that, but I would say that who on Max's side didn't think about that? And what, like, to me, it almost looks like there could have been an opportunity to go to Nike and say, hey, we've got the greatest racer of a generation right now, or, you know, the future of F1. Not taking away, that wasn't a shot on Lewis at all, because I think Lewis is one of the GOATs. But here's, like, the future of F1. This guy's going to win maybe another, you know, 4 championships, 5 championships, whatever. Hey, Nike, let's do this thing. What if he was like the Michael Jordan of F1, right? Where it's like you had the Jordan brand and you had the Max brand or whatever the hell it is, right? The Verstappen brand. But instead, now you've kind of pissed off Nike and you've got a potential legal, I don't know what the whole situation, if there's a big legal battle here, but I believe the trademarks that Nike owns are on Air and Max. And I think it's because of how they emphasize the word Max. Now, again, Max is a name, but once you start branding things, that goes down the window, right? It doesn't matter if your name is Vincenzo. If it's branded by somebody else somewhere else, then you're infringing on that. What's your take? You have a little bit of a different see on this. What do you see or what do you say about it?
Well, case in point, a couple years ago, I wanted to start a podcast called The VCast. And it was just going to be kind of a lifestyle podcast. And of course, if you're, I think, older than maybe 20, you remember Verizon had VCast. And so obviously I could not do that for very obvious reasons. I wanted to avoid the legal challenge, and I knew it would come if that ever came to fruition. So it's taking common sense here, right? And you think common sense would apply to most things, but obviously not with this. And Nike was right. It said in their filing that since it's common practice in the clothing sector for the same mark to be configured in different ways, the relevant public might also think that the contested sign is a submark of the opponent, which would be Nike. So again, to your point, this would have been a huge win for Nike had Nike and Max been able to come up with a partnership to create a shoe, a clothing line, or something, a subcategory under Nike, being, you know, giving him the flexibility to use all of this stuff. What I think is interesting is that Verstappen contested, but the Benelux Office for Intellectual Property sided with Nike and blocked Verstappen from producing goods under the Max 1 name. However, Nike didn't oppose the trademark for Max 1 services. So technically, Max could still use Max 1 for, say, he did driver camps or something that provided a service. He could still use that. He just could not use it in terms of clothing production. So he would be very limited
right.
What he could do there. So it's basically, yeah. You could say, I'm going to start a driver camp, but I can't create any merchandise. I can't even create a t-shirt. So you're very limited to what you can do there if you're Max Verstappen. So yeah, I think that it does create a level of confusion in the marketplace. If you see Max, if I were to see Max 1, a sweatshirt that said Max 1 at a Grand Prix, I would automatically associate that with Nike. Yeah. And it's that deceptive practice of clothing and marketing that mm-hmm. you do everything you can to avoid. And, you know, I genuinely don't know who on Max's team thought this was a good idea. Because, again, I don't have a law degree, you don't have a law degree, and yet, again, common practice. We know this.
So. And I would say, you know, from Max's side of things, it's like, take your shot, right? He's got the money to do that. Most, you know, I wouldn't have the money to go and like, you know what? I'll give it a shot. What's the worst that's going to happen? I don't know how much time and money was pumped into building the brand, because, you know, that's also something you have to take into consideration. But I would definitely say, if anyone could take that chance, it would be someone like a Max, because, hey, why not? I can fight it. His people can now call Nike and say, hey, why don't we do a collab? That's what I would do if I was running Max's brand. I'd say, hey, let's find a way to work with Nike on this. You know, how cool would this be to be able to leverage an iconic, I mean, Air Max, the Air Max Ones, I mean, those, like, all of that, those are iconic Nike products. If there's any way to be able to piggyback and launch something, that's a win. That's a win for Max. It's a win for everybody, right? You're gonna reach a bigger audience than you ever would by yourself, even though you are the sport's biggest star. Nike is recognized by everyone everywhere in the world, even if they don't, you know, even if they don't have F1 TV on their phones or whatever. You don't have to have a phone to know who Nike is. So I would say that there's still a way forward, just has to rethink it. But it does bring into, not question, but it brings up that point that you just made, and it is fascinating that, like, with all these trademarks and whatnot, it is like the details are very interesting to me. So it's like, oh, okay, go ahead. You could have a service company, but you can't have a clothing company because we sell clothing, but we don't have services, so go for it. It's interesting. It's one of those things to me where I'm like, oh, okay, so maybe I could come up with, like, Nike Consulting, and they're not going to stop me because it's like, well, we don't do consulting. Now, I would never use the name Nike. I'm just saying that, like, potentially. But the minute you step into some merchandise, or the minute you step into that world, it is like, you really need to do your research. You really, and I mean, these guys have the money for patent attorneys and branding people and marketing executives, advertise, you know, it's like, you have all of this. So could have avoided it. I don't feel bad. I think it's a learning lesson for Max or whoever's running this for him. I'm sure he's not racking his brain over it.
Well, it's interesting too, because now we're talking about Max having a clothing company. Now we're talking about him in that space. And so I think people know perhaps where he wants to go. I mean, and people are saying that this is potentially a move that he wants to make after he's done racing. And be that as it may, Max is not known for being, you know, a fashion icon. He wears the basic Red Bull kits with jeans and white sneakers pretty much every race. You see him in that look. And unlike Lewis, who has an entire wardrobe, he's never seen the same thing twice. And so it's like, what would Max clothing look like? Would it be sort of a Daniel Ricciardo, where he's got the Rick 3, the Enchanté? Like, would it be similar to that? Because obviously we know that AlphaTauri, that kind of stuff doesn't work in F1. It doesn't work for the F1 market. But what Daniel Ricciardo is doing is working. So, like, where is Max trying to go with this? You know what I mean? And further, I think we know what his end game is. We know what his goal is here. And so now you're going to have, especially big Max fans, saying, when's the drop coming? When is this coming? We want to wear a Max merchandise. We're tired of wearing Red Bull. We want to support Max. And, you know, it last year was so crazy because you had people saying, Max is canceled after the whole Checo debacle happened. Max, I mean, it was just this for about a month, and then it died off. And now people are like, okay, we like Max again. So you know that, you know, fans are very much, they forget. They forgive and forget pretty quickly in the sport. But at the same time, I think the leverage that a partnership with Max and Nike could potentially have is that we know that Formula One is a traveling circus. It is a global traveling circus. And so it has reach from Singapore to Vegas, Australia to Canada. I mean, name a sport with more reach than Formula One. So this would be a brilliant move by Nike to move in and say, okay, Max, we might have blocked you, but we want to work with you. I think that would be a brilliant partnership for sure.
Not to belabor this, but, you know, you brought up Danny Rick, and I think this is a good kind of closing spot for where we're at, because we've come full circle. Australian GP, we started this off with, and now we're talking about the Aussie himself, Danny Rick. He's, you know, he's spent a lot of time building up that personality, being friendly with, you know, not that Max is unfriendly, and that's not my intention there, but like Max comes across as more, you know, stoic and aloof and whatnot, focused on racing, which is great. But it's like, okay, hey, now you need to focus on building your brand. So he does, you know, some things have to change because you do want to become a little bit more likable by more than just, you know, your fan base. You kind of want to be liked by everybody. I mean, like, who hates Danny Rick, right? Nobody. Like, I and the brand, and here, and then let's go a little bit further from a branding perspective, because this is what I know and I'm good at. You know, Danny Rick stuff, Enchanté, that doesn't say Danny Rick on it. It could be anything. It could, you know, like, anybody could wear that and be like, oh, I've got this real dope sweater. I've got this real dope shirt. It's got this really nice design on it. It says Enchanté. Like, I'm not, oh, but if I had something that said like Max Verstappen on it, what do you think of it immediately when you have a player or an athlete's name on something? It's a jersey, right? Oh, that's a jersey. That's kind of casual. That's not really, I'll wear that when I go to the game, or I'll wear that if I'm watching a game in a pub or the bar with my friends. But Danny Rick stuff, like, oh, I'd wear that out. I'd wear that to the club. I'd wear that to the, you know, to brunch, whatever. I'd wear it to dinner. It's different. There's a different vibe to it, right? It feels more organic as opposed to just like, I'm going to slap my name on it, take advantage of the people that are going to spend whatever money because it's me, which is fine. There's nothing, I'm not saying anything's wrong with that, but it's like, think one step further. And I think that's where Danny, people like Danny, there's, you know, the other drivers too are doing stuff like this, but that's where Danny's done a good job versus how Max is like just starting to figure it out. And I think this is this is one step in that learning process.
Yeah. Well, at the same time, Max should probably consult Danny Rick because he's done it right, for sure. He has those limited drops and people want to get it, whatever they can get, whether it's a hat, whether it's a pair of socks, whether it's a sweatshirt. I have friends who every single time Danny Rick has a drop, they're posting their receipts and they're so excited about it. And yeah, I think that if there's anyone in Formula One right now that Max should be consulting on this, it's Daniel Ricciardo, because he's obviously got the team. They've done their homework. They know what they're doing and they know how to leverage this market and they know how to give people what they want. And you said, to your point, about anytime you have something on it that has an athlete's name, it's now a jersey. There's no other way around that. And so what Daniel has been able to do is really remarkable, I think, in the space of creating merchandise around your personality. And yeah, I think that he's definitely created, I think, the modern blueprint for other drivers and how they should be handling their own personal brands too, if they choose to go into the clothing space. And, you know, with Danny Rick now in the Red Bull garage again, I mean, it's the perfect time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, that brings us to a nice close, nice little pretty bow on the episode for today. It was good talking about all things Australia and some of the happenings of Formula One this week. As always, we appreciate you, the audience, the listeners. Please leave us a rating and review on your favorite podcast player. That helps us a lot and get into the ears of new folks. With that said, I'm Vincenzo.
I'm Bia.
We will see you next week.
Thank you so much for tuning into the VF1 show. If you liked it, please don't forget to hit the subscribe button. And for previews of next week's show, follow us on Instagram and Twitter at the VF Castro and Vincenzo Landino.